Stags is a six-part drama that follows groom-to-be Stu and his friends on his stag do in South America. What was meant to be a week of drink, debauchery and fun takes a dark turn. Instead of boarding a flight back to the UK, the Stags are sent to a lawless prison island. Quickly, it becomes clear that survival is not a given. Their friendships are tested and lifelong loyalties are sacrificed as Stu and his mates begin to question who will make it home alive. Sophie Ling Linger plays Clem and one of Stu's old college friends, and Sophie joins me now. Sophie, you're so welcome on Arena.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, I've heard of every kind of mashup to describe what Stags is. If they say Midnight Express meets The Hangover or Narcos meets Banged Up Abroad, how would you go about describing it?
Yeah, I think Narcos meets Banged Up Abroad was my one probably. I would go about, I mean, I think the description is pretty, you know, spot on. I think it's a story about, as you said, friendships being tested, but also moral codes being tested. And, you know, it's kill or be killed. You know, we meet these characters and I think we identify with them as an audience. And then you watch them and the situations that they're in. And you start to question yourself even, you know, would this bring the worst out in me too?
You know. So it begins with the lads going off on a stag do, and it's a strange mix of people because everybody has a friendship or a relationship with Stu. Mm. Just describe the relationships of the guys and your character with Stu.
Yeah, so Stu has friends from back home that he's grown up with, that he's had, you know, mad nights out with in his youth, and they all come together and are kind of those lads again. So they're, you know, celebrating, and then Clem and Hugo are his friends from college, and they're like a bit more strict. They're working professionals, independent, you know, living their best lives in London. They also know how to have a good time, but I think they're a bit less mad on the drink, you know.
And then how does he know your character?
From college. So they would have gone to college together. They probably would have shared a dorm or an apartment together and, you know, kept in touch. And then when it's, you know, you meet up again for these life highlights, getting married. So Clem agrees to go on the stag do because her friend Hugo from college is there too. I think if she'd have been the only one from his college, she might have not gone, but she's convinced at the end of the day.
Now, it's all going fine and people get maybe too drunk. Mm. Some people get less drunk than others and they all end up at the airport and then something goes terribly wrong.
Yes, then something does go very wrong. I'm not allowed to reveal it.
You're not allowed to reveal it, but we can say that it ends up that all the boys that we know of at the beginning end up on this, well, open prison might be a misnomer because it's not really an open prison. Mm-hmm. It's stay in or die.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, they all get arrested at the airport and sent off to this crazy prison island. And Clem is separated from the lads. Now, in the beginning is the question, why is she separated? Is it because she's sent to this woman's prison, perhaps? But you get to the island and you see that it's a mix and match. There's people of all ages, people of all genders. And Clem happens to be a veterinarian and she's got kind of an ace up her sleeve that also tests her in a lot of ways because she has this medical background and these skills that are kind of horribly repurposed in this prison world. So she ends up having to do things that she probably never would have imagined that she had to do, you know.
OK, well, that is a very good cue for the clip I have. Oh, and again, we can just present the clip and then people can make out what might be happening. Mm. In the clip, Stu and Ryan are on the prison island and looking for their friend Greg, who has been operated on. Mm. He obviously has been unwell and having swallowed a load of, he had swallowed some drugs at the airport. They're surprised to find Clem at the hospital and looking after Greg. So it's the first time they meet since landing at the prison. There's some strong language from your own character.
Yes,
so I'm just warning our listener. She's sorry about that, but she had to say it.
Clem, are you all right? Is this where they're keeping you?
Why are you... What's going on?
We're here for Greg.
Yeah, that bastard's answers, Mama.
Can you tell me what the fuck's going on, please, Stu? Can you tell me why I got shipped here alone? Straight into the care of some cracked bitch who's making me carve actual people up. A minute ago, I was on holiday, Stu. What even happened to him? What the fuck is going on, Stu?
Well, we want to ask him the same thing.
Yeah. Let's see if he's woke up. He's just through there. Can I trust you both to keep it together when you see him?
Of course. Of course.
Ryan, do you understand? You need to stay cool.
Sophie Linglinger there as Clem in Stags. So, your character in an awful situation in this terrible prison, and everybody has to try and be clever to try and survive. That seems to be your character. She's in control. She's trying to tell the others to behave. Is that how you see your character?
Yes, I think so. I think she's a peacekeeper, and both because she wants to stay alive and because she wants to, you know, not only because she wants everyone to be okay, but mostly I think because she wants herself to be okay. But I think she's smart. I think she knows how to work people. And, you know, we figure out throughout the series how we watch her get better at that, you know.
Now, the last time you were on Arena, you were in Galway. Yes. And you were performing in the O'Casey plays. Mm. So how did you land this wonderful job in Stags?
It actually came off the O'Casey's. I mean, I auditioned for it while we were in Belfast. And then
this was on the O'Casey tour.
Exactly. Yeah, we were just in Belfast in the Lyric Theatre. And, you know, I did the self-tape. And then after a few weeks, we had a call back. I flew to London for that to be in person. And then, I mean, it was just such a great atmosphere in the room when I was reading for her. You know, sometimes you feel like you really click with a character. And I felt that with Clem. And then it was just, you know, those 2-3 weeks of anxious waiting, waiting to hear back. And then I remember I got the call actually when I was back home in Vienna. And it was just amazing to be with my family when I got the news so that we could celebrate together. And how did I land it? I mean,
well, obviously you're a very talented actress. You're playing it very Irish.
Yes.
Was that, did you rehearse in, because your accent isn't completely Irish, or it's
no,
not
it's,
your natural accent.
Yeah. I don't know what my natural accent is. I mean, any role I play, I usually put on an accent because it's, my accent is kind of a hybrid in a way. But yeah, I did, you know, the character description said Irish girl, you know.
Oh, right. So it was an Irish girl in the script. Yes. I was wondering whether you were so au fait with your Dublin accent that you had.
That did definitely help.
In the O'Casey's. Now, tell us about the team behind it. David Kerr is involved in it. We know him from the Johnny English films.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. He was wonderful. I mean, I was very, you know, nervous getting to set because I'd never worked on such a big project, let alone camera. But he was just so kind and answered all of my questions, and there were a lot of questions, and took the time with us, you know, to rehearse and go through the scenes before we would shoot. And you
yes
know,
because they're slapsticky as well as quick dialogue, isn't it? So it's quite demanding.
Exactly, yeah. But he gave us that freedom as well to like play around with them a little bit. Obviously you always fall back and rely on the text, but if there was something that came up, he would, you know, give you the time and talk you through it, you know.
And then your co-stars, did you know any of them before, except from the rehearsal room maybe, or rather the audition?
No, actually, I'd never met any of them before, but they were all so lovely. We had a real bonding experience, I think. We were all living on the same complex and, you know, we'd go for morning swims, go have some breakfast, then go to prison.
Yes, because it was Tenerife you filmed it in. Yes,
yeah.
So that must have been very nice, very holistic.
It was lovely. I mean, it was a dream to be there for so long and then to be with such an amazing group of people. You know, we were all so lucky and everyone suited their character so well. It was just a great joy to work with them. Yeah.
Now, I've seen about 2 episodes, I think. How dark does it get?
Oh, it gets dark.
Because at the beginning, you know, because it's Stag and there's a lot of repartee between all the characters, you think, oh, is it comedy? What is it? And then suddenly you realise, no,
it's not a
comedy.
I think you get to the end of episode 1 and you're like, what is going on? That's how I felt when I read it. And that's kind of what I loved about it as well, because I thought it was original. It surprises you and it, you know, it kind of reels you in and then it shocks you. And I think that's really fun.
Now, your introduction to Ireland was the Lear.
Yes.
So because you're not Irish, you're not born Irish. And so you came to the Lear. Did you choose it or why did you come to the Lear?
Yeah, I moved away from home to London first when I was 18. And then I did a foundation course there. And from there, I just applied to a lot of drama schools. And the Lear, I think I was lucky in the sense that it was my first audition. So I came in with a lot of excitement. And the atmosphere was just amazing. And the people, I just felt really at home. And yeah, then I made the decision to move over, and it was the best decision I ever made.
And what did you know anything about the theatre world or the film world here in Ireland at the time?
Not at all. Not at all. I knew I liked Irish stories from studying them at school. You know, I remember we read Evelyn, I think, from the Dubliners. And then getting to know those plays, you know, obviously the O'Casey plays or Marina Carr, all these like amazing Irish writers. I just fell more and more in love with it the longer I was here.
And then when you, was the O'Casey then your first, well, your first big roles in the professional theatre?
I did a play for The Fringe, Absent the Wrong. That was my first show out of the Lear. And then the O'Caseys were after that. That was a way bigger project, a way longer project. So I really, I learned a lot on that as well. I got to work with so many cool like Irish actors that I admire.
Yes, of course. And you, I mean, you had that wonderful role of Nora in The Plough and the Stars.
Yeah, it was amazing. I remember seeing my other the other half of my year doing it for a project that they were doing, and I'd never seen it before. And I remember watching, and I was like, I fell in love with Nora. I was like, wow, what a great role. And I was like, I'd love to play her. But then in my head, I was also checking myself, being like, okay, I'm Austrian and not white. I don't know how realistic this is. But then getting the audition for it, I mean, it was just such a joy getting the audition itself, you know. So,
yes. Amazing. And working with Druid then and working with Gary Hines and her wonderful ensemble of actors.
Yeah. It was, as I said, it was amazing. And they all, again, took me under their wing and, you know, weren't afraid of, or I wasn't afraid of them, I should say. they were also welcoming and, you know, just watching them, I learned a lot. And I could always go to them for advice or to Gary. And yeah, it was a really lovely experience as well.
Now, you mentioned you were Austrian there. So you're from Vienna, is
yes.
that right? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and your English is impeccable. Like,
thank you.
You know, you don't sound accented in any way.
No, I did grow up bilingually. So I went to bilingual school from the age of 3. Yeah. So it was always in my life.
Now, we spoke to Janet Moran and Colin Morrison yesterday, and you were one of the actors in Afterwards, her play, which is about three women in a recovery room after having an abortion in England. And
yes.
It's looking back at the referendum here and what it's meant and what it hasn't meant for women.
Mm.
Tell us a little bit about your character in that.
So my character is an English solicitor, and she is in this recovery ward, as you say, you know, with these two Irish women. And the question comes up is, you know, why are these two Irish women here? You know, don't you guys have abortion now in Ireland? You know, and, you know, the conversation keeps going from there. And what I love about the play is that these three women come from different walks of life. They made this decision for different reasons. And it's not that they all come in there and they are, you know, in solidarity necessarily, you know, there's different judgments that come up, and it's just a great play to watch, you know, watch them talk through it all, you know.
Yes, because there's a feeling that the English woman, you know, is blasé about things, whereas in fact that is far from the truth.
Yeah.
And she then queries the other. She's a very good truth finder again.
Yes.
A bit like, you know, about the young woman and what the young woman might be experiencing.
Yeah. Yeah, she is a bit different than to the other two characters. But, you know, we get to know all three women and see them as full rounded human beings and watch them debate this topic on stage. And I think it's such an important thing to see on stage for a lot of women, because a lot of women feel alone in this choice and they're not. And they can see this on stage, you know.
Now, you're also working on a film this summer.
I did work on a film in,
oh, right.
in
so
spring.
It, so it's all right. So yeah. is it done? Is it in the
it
can?
Is. Yeah. I don't know when it is out actually or where.
Okay.
It's called Whitetail.
Right. And can you tell us a little bit about it?
I would describe it as a coming of age story, but a bit later in life. So we meet this woman, Jen, in her early 40s, and she's coming to terms with something traumatic that happened in her youth. And my character, Brett, they're both in this very small Irish town. And my character, Brett, is this girl from Los Angeles that arrives there and kind of feels misplaced, out of place, doesn't really know how to cope. And the two of them bond because they kind of feel the same, even though they come from very different places. And yeah, it was a joy to work on that as well.
Okay, so we could look out for that maybe later on in the year.
Yeah, probably later on in the year or early next year, I'd say.
Well, Sophie, thank you so much for coming in to speak to us. Stags is available from Thursday, the 15th of August on Paramount Plus. After the guts of six decades in the music business, the singer Tom Waits has a fan base with a sense of loyal devotion that most other artists can only dream of. His distinctive gravelly voice and knack for illuminating the fringes of society in his songs has made his work enduring and adaptable. And now a new play with music is about to open in Dublin. The Long Way Home tells the story of Tom Waits' devotee Jack, a singer who is down on his luck in more ways than one, and the play incorporates many Waits classics as well as a few B-side gems. The Long Way Home is co-written by stars Jack Healy, and it's directed by Paul Nugent, and it opens at Smock Alley in Dublin next week. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Paul Nugent and Jack Healy, and we are going to start with some Tom Waits music. And Jack, you're going to sing Way Down the Hole. Introduce the song to us and then maybe sing it for us, if you wouldn't mind.
All right. Way Down the Hole. I'll do the short version. I think this was, for a lot of listeners might recognise this, it was the theme tune in The Wire, a TV show. But anyway, it's a Tom Waits classic. Here we go.
There's gold, but you gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. Yeah, you gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. Yeah, you gotta keep the devil way down in the hole.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Jack. And that is such, Paul, that's just such a good introduction, really, to the show, because your character in the play, I was going to say Tom. Jack is just going to go over and sit beside Paul. The central character in your show is very much way down and trying to keep the devil way down in the hole, isn't he? Yes. Tell us a little bit about the central character.
So Jack plays Jack Moriarty. So he's a singer who had better days. You know, there was a time when he was maybe one of the great pub singers in Dublin. But yeah, he's let his life go astray at this point. So both his marriage and his health and his career as a singer are on their last legs. So very much like a Tom Waits character.
Yes. And Jack, you're trying to be sober, but it's not working out great as the play progresses.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's the monkey on his shoulder, you know, and he's trying to walk the straight and narrow path, basically. And there's a lot of variables going on in his little world that distract him. But he's, you know, it's addiction and the pursuit of happiness for him largely, because he's chasing the bottle, you know, all the time. And it's quite a sad story to a certain point until it turns, you know. Mm-hmm.
So the two of you co-wrote this.
No. It was co-written by Jack and a writer called Dave Couser, and I helped develop the show.
Right. And so obviously you had the Tom Waits in you, Jack. So why did you decide to write this show, you know, as a theatrical piece?
It kind of grew organically and very quickly with Dave Couser, my co-writer, who I've been working with for years and years. And I sing in a band called Bone Machine, play the music of Tom Waits, the tours a lot. And it seemed to be like just a natural step forward for singing those songs, you know, to take it to a theatre, build some kind of stage play around it, you know, put drama around it. And it's, you know, it's very much drama with music as opposed to being a full-blown My Fair Lady musical. Mm.
Yes, and you decided that it would be about somebody who discovers that they, you know, or that they know that they sing like Tom Waits and should develop that. Even though, rather than you could have written a musical about Tom Waits. Mm.
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, this guy, Jack Moriarty, largely identifies with the fact very early in his little world that the songs of Tom Waits pretty much save his life. And essentially, they are little parables and stories in each song that he identifies deeply with that keep him off the bottle, keep him on the straight and narrow, throws him onto the bottle again and drives him mad. And, you know, the entire play is like that. The entire play actually is like one long Tom Waits ballad, you know, a beginning, middle and end, Aristotelian construct kind of thing.
Is that what you thought, Paul, when you read it first?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was just something about it, that the story kind of was reflective of the kind of stories you get in a Tom Waits song. You know, of somebody who's seemingly down on their luck, has a lot of history, but there is that glimmer of hope, but a glimmer of hope in broken glass, if you know what I mean.
Yes, and it is of the night, as is the music of Tom Waits. I mean, it's in kind of dingy bars late at night, and maybe things are said under, you know, when people have too much alcohol on board and people. But it's quite primal the way people are trying to look. It gives a little bit of the story. Yeah. Your character is playing in a bar, and he's lost the love of his life, really.
Exactly. Yeah, his wife is doing her best to get away from him, and that, and the bottle is pulling him through the floor, and he's singing other songs, classic Irish numbers, actually at the beginning of the show, and he's overheard by the girl that runs the bar and the club. Is singing a Tom Waits song, and she says, you know, if you sang Waits songs here every night, we'd pack the place, you'd have your old job, like, and the whole thing. It flowers from there on for him. He realizes that, actually, yeah, I'm built from the ground up to do this. But it's true that, Tom Waits himself he's always been a champion of the underdog in society and, you know, people operating on the fringes of nightlife, etc., and the subculture. So that's very much a part of Jack Moriarty's character. You know, he's right in there in the grit and the grain of real urban life. And but you know, his story and this play, it's a universal tale. So it's really going to connect, hopefully, with people.
Maybe we should listen to a little Tom Waits before we go to the break for the New Oct. This is Downtown Train, taken from his 1985 album Rain Dogs. That's Downtown Train, sung there by Tom Waits. And I'm here with the director of The Long Way Home, Paul Nugent, and the star, Jack Healy, who also has a tribute band to Tom Waits. That song, is that in your repertoire?
It's one of the first ones we learned, I think, when we put the band together, you know. And after hearing Tom singing it, the next guy I heard on radio singing that a long time ago was Rod Stewart. I think it would have been a big hit with it. As have a lot of artists had hits with Tom's songs, like Springsteen had released Jersey Girl, and the Eagles did Old 55. So Tom's well bled into the charts there in spots, you know.
And do you think he's a once-off talent? You know, people might describe him like Nick Cave or like other artists, but do you think he's unique in what he does?
I think without question the man is unique, and he's also an incredible actor and writer and musician and producer, as is his wife, Kathleen Brennan, who has produced and co-written, for me, most of his best songs, you know.
The Long Way Home is a musical based on the music of Tom Waits, and I'm here with the director, Paul Nugent, and its star, Jack Healy. Jack, when did you always know you could sing like Tom Waits, or did somebody have to tell you, you sound very like Tom Waits?
Yeah, I think it was the lack of invitations into choirs that really triggered it. No, I was in, I think more than 10 years ago, I was fortunate enough to bump into Daniel Lanois, who's a music producer here in Dublin.
Of course.
And we started to become really friendly, like socially, having the crack. He was working like with U2 at the time on a record. But one night, he was staying in the Shelburne for a couple of months. And one night we were in his room bashing guitars. And he said, God, you sound really like Tom Waits. And he said, you should sing some of his songs. And I think he gave me a record closing time. But That was it, basically. I mean, I went, yeah.
And how well did you know his music at that stage?
I didn't really, to be honest with you, like, except the odd hit I'd heard late night on Dave Fanning's show. But,
And what kind of music were you performing? Were you a full-time musician at that stage, Jack?
Not full-time. I was working as an art director in advertising, above the line advertising, and where I met Dave Couser, my co-writer. He's a copywriter. And I was playing a lot of traditional Irish music, and I'm from Milltown Malbay in County Clare, so it's kind of a bait into you down there.
But, you can't avoid it.
In a good way. But and then I was playing a lot of rock music and stuff, and working in an original rock band called the Van Diemen's that just was not washing its face, not making a penny, couldn't pay the rent kind of scenario. So I had to keep working the ad agencies. And I think it was just hanging out with Dan, and obviously he's a producer and his ears were triggered. He went, "Man, you sound like Waits. You got to give it up, brother. You got him in you." And that was pretty much it. And it only took one album. I mean, I heard, listened to that album, and I went, ran out and bought all Tom's albums. That was it.
And you then put a band together.
Yeah, I was, at the time, the original music wasn't making a living for me. And I was playing to, you know, friends and family and five people and a dog. And I think we booked one gig for Bone Machine, played the music of Tom Waits in the Grand Social here in town. And it was 2 months out, the publicity kicked in. And about, I'd say, 3 or 4 weeks before the first gig, I got about like 100 phone calls. "Can you come and play here and sing there, the music of Tom Waits?" So it caught fire very quickly. And thankfully, we toured the theatres and stuff at it now, as well as clubs. And it's great. I mean, I owe a lot to Tom and Kathleen, basically.
Well, let's listen to some more of Tom. This is the classic Martha. Sorrows and Martha there, written and performed by Tom Waits and taken from his 1973 debut, Closing Time. Tom Waits, he's aware of your band and he's aware of you?
He is, I mean, absolutely. And that for the last 10 years of gigging, we return our live royalties through Imro to Tom Waits, you know, and his publishers. So yeah, every time we play a gig, basically, he gets a few quid from us playing his songs. And but I'm not on the Christmas card list or anything like that yet.
That song does remind me of that central relationship between Jack and Reyes, doesn't it? In the play, that Martha, it's like it's one of these kind of enduring love relationships that have their ups and downs. They kind of, you know, they kind of enable each other in bad ways, and then there's a real strong love there.
Yeah, and this kind of stories that they kind of met in rehab, you know, from both being drinkers, and the Tom Waits songs got them through rehab. But then afterwards, you know, they have a honeymoon period, but then the demon drink comes haunting again for both of them. And they both go through periods when the relationship kind of falls apart. When we join our story, it's Jack, who's now really in a bad state. And it's Teresa who's trying to hold on, trying to still be part of him. But she's, as she says, one of the lines of the play, she's hanging on by her fingernails at this point.
Yes. And you have obviously had to have a relationship with the Tom Waits estate for this, because you'd have to have passed the show and to use the music in the show.
Yeah, we were able to, luckily through a connection of Jack's, a friend of his, Paddy Doherty, was able to link us up with Paul Charles, who's Tom Waits' agent. And Jack sent a very passionate letter as part of our application. We recorded all the songs in the show to send to Mr. Waits, and had a lovely day, and we got a lovely email saying, "Mr. Tom Waits and Kathleen Brennan officially approve you guys to do the show," which was a great day.
How exciting. How exciting for you, Jack.
It's kind of mind-blowing, all right, getting that email. And
And how have you, what has the acting been like? That's another challenge for you. I mean, I'm sure Paul has been guiding you all the way here.
Largely the play has grown out of my relationship with Paul, in that I was studying acting at the Gaiety School of Acting, and Paul was my main tutor. And I think a couple of months in, I passed him the script, which was seriously underdeveloped. Just crazy, loose. But he untangled it. And about a month later, he said, "Hey, like, this is pretty decent. I think we could make something with it." Yeah. And I think from that point on, the characters, with Paul's direction, etc., the characters really rounded out, and we worked on the script nonstop, but it has taken over a year to do it, you know.
What's the setting, Paul? Is it the bar?
There's two main settings. We have the bar, which is Fannin's bar, where Jack works, and is run by Margot, the tough-ass bartender and, as she says, former backing singer and muse to Tom Waits. And the other setting is the Heart Attack and Dine. It's a diner, which is kind of, that's like, so the bar is the nighttime setting and the diner is kind of where Jack's character goes in the morning, where he encounters Ali, who's a budding young singer, not just the waitress in the diner.
And you then have co-stars. You have three co-stars.
Yeah. The characters are Teresa, who plays my wife, is played by Darina Gallagher. And Ali, who's the waitress, is played by Carla De Burca. And coincidentally, I'm Margot, who runs the bar and club and is...
Who gets a bad rap.
Yeah, is actually Paul's wife, Anna Nugent, well-known actor.
Yeah, there's no nepotism there at all.
Well, look at my thanks to Jack Healy and Paul Nugent. The Long Way Home opens at Smock Alley in Temple Bar on August the 21st, which is Wednesday of next week, and runs until August the 31st. We're going to end with another piece of music from Tom Waits. This is Hold On from his 1999 album Mule Variations, and more information on the show from smockalley.com.
They hung a sign up in our town: if you live it up, you won't live it down. So she left Monte Rio's son, just like a bullet leaves a gun. With a charcoal eyes and Monroe hips, she went and took that California trip. Well, the moon was gold and her hair like wind. Said, don't look back, just come on, Jim. Oh, you got to hold on, hold on. You got to hold on, take my hand. Standing right here, you got to hold on. Well, he gave her a dime store watch and a ring from a spoon. Everyone's looking for someone.
That's Hold On from Tom Waits' 1999 album Mule Variations, and you can get more information from about The Long Way Home, that show with the music of Tom Waits, from smockalley.com. Donal Ryan made his name as a writer 12 years ago with his first novel, The Spinning Heart, set in and around his native Nenagh in County Tipperary. The book takes us back to the days of the Celtic Tiger, the financial crash, and nearly forgotten phrases like Nama and Ghost Estates. One of the most memorable things about it is its structure. It told 21 short chapters with 21 voices getting equal weight as they relayed the story of a community caught in the fallout of the crash. After another 5 novels and short story collection, Ryan returns to those 21 characters in his new book, Heart Be at Peace. The year is now 2019. Bobby Mahon and his wife Trina are once again at the heart of the story, and this time the crisis is drugs and the ease with which young local dealers are openly operating. Paula Shields has been reading Heart Be at Peace for us and joins me now in studio. So, Paula, though Heart Be at Peace has multiple characters like the spinning heart had, Bobby Mahon is still quite central in this piece. He starts it off and his wife, Trina, finishes the story. How do we find him post Celtic Tiger?
In much better shape. We're 10 years on from the crash. It's faded into the background of the lives of everybody. And in The Spinning Heart, Bobby was the foreman who, at the best of times, was clearing a grand a week, quote unquote. And then suddenly he's out of work and his employer Pokey Burke has vanished and is not to be found. Now, Bobby himself has become the boss. He started up a construction company doing attics and insulations. He and his wife, Trina, are living in a grand house on the hill. They now have a daughter to add to the son. And these kids, Erin and Rob, are teenagers. So he's in good shape as this starts.
Now, as you as we said there, there's a lot of drugs in the community, and one of the characters who you mentioned there, Pokey Burke, who was an employer on the construction sites where Bobby and various other people worked, and he left town with money and without paying wages and left everybody in the lurch. He's back.
He's back, the rotter. And not only had he left unpaid wages, he hadn't been paying the men's stamps. So in the Spinning Heart, these guys can't get the dole even because their national insurance hasn't been paid. So he is an absolute crook, and he ran off. And what we learned through his father, Josie, because Pokey, interestingly, is not one of the 21 voices who gets his own chapter. He's away for 7 years. He comes back. He cries. The father is moved but can't go towards him.
The father's always a softie.
He's a lovely man. And there's a lot about men not being able to communicate in both books. So Pokey is back and he's starting a language school ostensibly. But of course, he's up to his old tricks and he's working for a guy in Malta. And the father finds out the hard way that this language school he's allegedly running in Limerick is a front for a drugs operation.
Now, let's go back to the way it's told again. As you say, it's 21 voices over 21 chapters, and each individual voice tells a little layer of the story as we go along. And really, it does build in tension. The characters themselves are individually interesting, and then all of a sudden you get a little bit more information on either Bobby's drama or on the drugs issue, which seems to have seeped into the community.
That's right. There's no omniscient narrator. And in a way, Bobby is the linking factor, because quite often a character will comment on him, or, you know, his wife, his father, lots of people. But one of the great pleasures of the book is you're always piecing things together. And later on, somebody will say something that makes you rerun in your own mind an earlier chapter. And you think, oh, that's what happened there. And, you know, there's a great sense of building tension as well, because some of this book is about, you know, what is a good man? I think Donal Ryan is thinking, what is parenting and what is a good man? And even at the outset, Bobby is saying, well, my wife is very worried about these drug dealers. They seem to operate with impunity. And what about our teenagers? And Bobby's fears kind of escalate. But we hear that from other people. So you're always building. You know, he gives the reader work to do, I think, in the most interesting way.
Yes. Now, Bobby has his own problems, though. I mean, Bobby seems to have the perfect life. As you said, he's got a new business. They're earning so much money. And Trian is happy. And they've now two children. They're the perfect family. But he has he's messed up.
Bobby has an ability to get into scrapes. So he is the kind of hero. But at the start of this book, he's just come back from a stag do in Amsterdam that he didn't really want to go on. The brother of Shawnee Shaper, one of his old friends who works for him now. And of course, what happened in Amsterdam was there was a lot of drink taken, and Bobby was kind of pushed into going into a brothel. And there's a compromising photograph of him coming out of the brothel. And of course, we're in the days of WhatsApp. This photograph starts doing the rounds, and you can feel one of Bobby's explosions is he's panicked about this. He doesn't tell his wife Trina. He's still not able to talk to her. But people are looking at him differently, and he knows he lives in a village. It's small town Ireland. A lot of us grew up there. You know, it's that place where people talk and whisper.
Yes, so we know. So all is not perfect.
No.
And then there's, we talked about the drugs problem, but there's violence everywhere, and there's the threat of violence everywhere. Mm-hmm. And is it a Bridie's story?
Yes.
She lives in Nina, and there is a burglary in her life, which is really, it's so tense, and it is so, I wasn't able to sleep that after reading it.
It's the stuff of nightmares. And, you know, Bridie has come from, in The Spinning Heart, she'd lost a son in a drowning accident, and it had wrecked her life and her marriage. And here in Heartbeat Peace, she's working in a hotel. She's moved back to the hometown of Nina. And then one night, these two guys come in. They break into her house. They have a hammer and a knife, a jagged knife. Really horrible setup. And they threaten her. And she's terrified. And then finally, she snaps at them. And one of them hits her with the hammer. And the other one punches her in the... Like, it's a really... awful, awful attack. And they take her money and they, you know, 100 euros. I mean, it's just desperate stuff. But they threaten her. And one of the most chilling things about it is her response, because she goes into work the next day. And, you know, her brother is Jim Gildee, who's a retired guard. She tells nobody, partly through shame and partly because she's afraid. You know, it's the most chilling scene.
The other characters then, can you tell us something of how this whole drugs culture developed? How do we find out about it? Who's involved in it?
There's a gang of young ones. One of the new things about this book is there are teenagers and who were little kids in the last book. But Augie Penrose is the kind of leader of this younger crop of hoodlums. Is probably too kind a word, actually, thinking about it. But he is working for Pokey. And Donald, through various characters, takes us into the place where the cocaine is being cut and bagged, and into the various... There's a young guy, Brian, who's in debt to Augie Penrose by 30 grand. So he's going to get in real deep water. Like, it's not just the fact that the drugs are illegal. It's also the consequences, the fact that they're preying on people and using them to commit other crimes, basically.
Yes, and there's all those things that you think are just in the cities, that how people prey on younger people and make them responsible for paying, having to pay back loads of money.
Yeah, it's properly nasty. You know, Donald Ryan is not afraid to go to the tough places and the dark places. Like, Augie Penrose is a horrible, brilliant creation, you know, who really knocks his girlfriend Millicent around, and who seems to have no empathy, or, you know, he's really nasty. But it's also that idea that Bobby is a force for good in the community. He's kind of leader, he's a local employer, and he's getting more and more wound up, because even though these guys are sitting in their car on the streets of a village, not even Nina, a village, operating, you know, in open air, there's nothing anybody can do. And that's the really scary thing.
You mentioned Millicent there, or Millie, and her grandmother, who Lily, who is a lovely character as well. And again, Millie has come back into her life after a bit of coldness with her son, I think. Mm-hmm. And she wants to keep her, but keeping her on side, it makes her, you know, in danger of getting in with Millie's friend, who is the aforementioned Augie, the bad guy.
That's right. She's afraid to warn Millie against him. She talks about, interestingly, Frank Mahon, Bobby's father, who was an appalling person, and Augie are the two people who are described as cold, which is the most damning word in a Donald Ryan story. But Lily, you know, was a character who had a wild youth in the first book, and a lot of her grown-up children don't really talk to her because there's too many men and it's all that. And of course, the granddaughter then, Millie, is curious about her and comes to see her, makes that connection, and her father, Huey, who is Lily's son, comes back into the picture. But there's a lovely bond between them that you often get when you've skipped a generation, and they're good friends, and she'll say Millie knows her better than, sees her more than other people do. But Lily is this interesting character who has all kinds of knowledge about herbs, and who unfortunately has a big amount of cash in the house that she tells Millie about. And, you know, that takes us to terrible places as well.
Now, Colm Tobin has done it. Now Donald Ryan is doing it. Going back to a much loved book and doing, you know, a new version of it.
Yes. And in some ways you think it's a bit of a risk going back. But I reread The Spinning Heart before reading this, and I loved it every bit as much this time as I did in 2012. And I think if anything, he's just built on that. And I think these are some of his finest books to date.
And do you think Heart Be At Rest is every bit as good as The Spinning Heart?
I do. And I'd advise people to read The Spinning Heart first and then go to this.
Well, Paula Shields, thank you very much. Heart Be At Peace by Donal Ryan is published by Doubleday. And Donal is in conversation with Alex Clark this Thursday at 8 p.m. at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. Further details from paviliontheatre.ie. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose Sanwu. Ruth Kennington is on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. And John Creedon is next.